Great. Thank you everyone so much for coming tonight to our event. It's great to have everyone here. My name is Sarah and I am a member of Health for All and known as Legal. I'm going to start by just providing a bit of context for the event and then introduce our speakers, and we'll have a question and answer period right after our speakers. Each one's going to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes. The idea for tonight's event, Fixing a Broken Healthcare System for Immigrants and Refugees, actually came out of a lot of the feedback that we had for an event in November, which was called Crossing the Borders in Health. This event had some brilliant panelists, a few of them who are here in the room tonight. So we had really good feedback on that event, saying they were very well spoken and all very good looking. And they had a As you can see, that's a theme that we have going. But this event focused on the limited access to healthcare for persons who are undocumented and underinsured in Ontario, who are living with IFH or in the 3-month wait period. The feedback that we got from this panel was that the majority of the professionals who are in the room are already really acutely aware of the issues that their clients are facing every day. And what they said that it was a good event and that it was really great to get to talk together, but what people actually wanted was an event where we could look at solutions that are available, solutions that have been created, and some of the people that we have in the room tonight who have been really amazing galvanizers in those solutions. People wanted an event or an opportunity to focus on access to care that their clients face. And this call for more solutions, this call for action and organizing amongst healthcare professionals and migrant populations is actually coming because the situation for migrants and refugees in Canada is becoming more and more dire. The number of clients who we are having without legal immigration status is increasing due to backwards immigration policies and programs, and an immigration and refugee board whose decisions are based not on justice but on quotas. This year, the federal government more than halved the number of refugees to be accepted from 29,000 to 12,000. This is not a decision that is based on the reality that the world is becoming a safer place. In fact, statistics show that it's not. And we know that many of the Canadian companies' investments and occupations are the cause of a lot of the displacement that is causing people to seek refuge in Canada, and why people require healthcare here too. So with more and more undocumented persons living in Ontario without health insurance and requiring healthcare, as we all do, we have to find solutions. And as healthcare professionals, as people interested in policy, and as the friends and lovers of people who are living here without immigration status or who are under and uninsured, we have to vision, design, and implement solutions for access to healthcare that are comprehensive, holistic, and grounded by the complex determinants of health that these particular populations face. Health for all doesn't just mean health insurance for everyone. The struggle is a lot more broad than that. It means access to healthcare that is culturally appropriate. It means increased social assistance rates. It means affordable housing. It means food that is nutritious, available, and culturally appropriate as well. It also means continuing to end racism, homophobia, and xenophobia, and addressing the social determinants of health that force people into the situation where they're coming to seek health care in the first place. So the campaigns for increased health insurance in Ontario and Canada are campaigns in a fight for social justice, as we acknowledge the colonial and imperial realities of Canadian foreign and domestic policy that force migration and impact health status of so many people that cross our borders and come into our clinics. We are very, very fortunate tonight to have Jackie Esmond, who's an immigration lawyer. She's here tonight to discuss some of the legal considerations of access to healthcare in Ontario. We're also very fortunate to have Medrashi and Manavi Handa, who will be here to talk about midwifery model and community health centers. These models of care have been demonstrating leadership, innovation, and compassion in the way that they have negotiated solutions for their clients with provincial governments. So we're so happy to have everyone here tonight. Each speaker, as I said, has 10 to 15 minutes. After all of our speakers, we're going to have a question and answer period, so please write down your questions and remember any questions that you have for the speakers at the end. A brief announcement, because I know people often have to leave in the middle of these events. Health for All is going to be having a meeting for individuals who are interested in working on building a grassroots campaign for more broad access to healthcare. There is information on the front table, and also this is the location and the room. It's at Oisey on March 9th at 7 p.m. So without further ado, we have Jackie Esmond. She is a graduate of Osgoode Hall Law School, where she finished in the top 1% of her class. She was called to Ontario Bar in 2003. She maintained a diverse civil rights approach at Roche, Schwartz & Associates, including representation of members of the George family at the Ipperwash Inquiry. Jackie joined Falconer Charney LLP in 2007. Since joining the firm, she has continued in public interest work, including providing research and drafting support to the School Community Safety Advisory Panel and acting as co-counsel to a coalition of Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto, Anishinaabe, Eskimo Nation, and Gooch Inquiry, and also saving the butts of many activists in the jail. So thank you so much for coming, Jackie.
Start off with the story of a gentleman who I was working with a few years ago. I was contacted initially by a social worker from a community center who was trying to help a very sick man who had come to her for help. But this was a man who was 65. He was originally from Jamaica, but he had been living in Canada since the 1960s, working on the trains. He worked for 40 years, he had a family, he paid his taxes, he bought property, he did everything that we all do in our everyday lives, and then he retired, and that's when he discovered that he didn't have status in Canada. He thought he did. He came here, he'd been working, he'd been doing everything that everybody else with status in Canada does. He'd been accessing health care. And he couldn't remember what happened 40 years ago when he initially came to Canada. He thought he had status. It turned out he didn't. It turned out that the health care he was getting was through private insurance that had been being provided by his employer for 40 years that ended with his retirement. So he found himself suddenly having to deal with status issues and very serious health issues. He had developed a serious heart condition that required surgery, and he was in no position to pay the private fees that would be required in order to get treatment. Now, he was shocked, the social worker was shocked, to discover that as somebody who'd been a long-term resident of Canada, that he was not able to access health care. He'd been paying taxes all these years. But I'm sure almost all of you in this room know his story is far from unique. I'm sure it's something that many of you see very regularly in your work. And there are many terrible stories of gentlemen like that who were long-term residents, who become ill and who cannot access health care. I was doing a lot of research before I came here. I was a bit intimidated by my panelists who are so knowledgeable in this area. And I came across a study that found in 2007 they interviewed a number of workers, healthcare workers and providers in Quebec, and there was a coroner who spoke about that within the past year, he could identify at least four cases in which people had died because they had delayed accessing health care because they were not insured. They were immigrants and refugees, people who were long-term residents of Canada. Again, in preparing for this event, I thought I'd check out what Health Canada had to say about the issue. And I was initially pleasantly surprised to find that they have a whole section of their website that's devoted to what they identify as issues of healthcare accessibility, which is an area of research that they're conducting. And they had a series of reports that were dealing with what they called issues in equity and responsiveness in access to healthcare in Canada. So I thought, well, this is a good sign that Health Canada cares about some of the things that I care about too. And then I read some of the reports, and my pleasure turned to dismay. So let me just show you one surprising conclusion that I read in some of the reports. Newcomers to Canada generally do not face barriers related to availability of services. Most are eligible for health care coverage on arrival, and for the past several years, even refugee claimants have emergency and needed health care service provided under the interim federal health program. Because many newcomers have lower incomes than the general population, they often face financial barriers to uninsured services. However, refugees are eligible for social assistance while they are seeking employment, and so are often covered for many non-assured health benefits. So at least this report was quite satisfied that issues of accessibility to health care is not a major issue in terms of for many immigrants and refugees to Canada. Instead, it focuses for the remainder of the report on issues of cultural difference and language as barriers to healthcare, rather than some of the issues of that we'll be talking about today. So, what I'll try to cover in the time that I have, what I'll first talk about, since I'm Lauren, supposed to talk about the legal issues, I'll talk about how it is that we have what I would call a system of legalized discrimination against immigrants and refugees in this country. I will briefly address the issue of the federal interim health benefit that the report I just referred to suggests is some excellent replacement for access to OHIP, and suggests that, in fact, it's far from a replacement for OHIP. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about the ways in which our flawed immigration system actually creates categories of precarious status and ensures the presence of undocumented workers and people without status in Canada, and some of the reasons why I think we should all care about and support a campaign for health for all. So first of all, turning to legal barriers to medical care for immigrants and refugees. Now, we have something in Canada called the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There's international law. There's a number of human rights documents that speak very clearly to that the right to health care is a right that is shared by everyone, and that is not something that should be based on your nationality, your country of origin, and so on. And yet, in Canada, we have a Canada Health Act that specifically provides that insurance, health insurance, is for people who are lawfully entitled to be or to remain in Canada. And it's the Canada Health Act, then, that is the ultimate source of the exclusion of many immigrants and refugees from access to OHIP in Canada. Now, the language, person lawfully entitled to remain in Canada, it's actually fairly broad. Like, that could be interpreted narrowly, and that could be interpreted broadly to include large numbers of immigrants and refugees. And so you'll find that the way that plays out across the country can really vary. So each province has their own interpretation of what that means, and different definitions of who has legal status and who does not in terms of access to health care. And that, for me, is one key indicator that this is a very unprincipled system, if you can have that kind of variance across the country. Now, in Ontario, the way that that phrase is defined in the Health Insurance Act in Ontario, there are certain categories of immigrants and refugees who can access health care. So obviously, if you're a citizen or you're a permanent resident, then you have access to OHIP. Then accepted refugees or protected people, they're called protected persons, have access to OHIP. People who have passed first stage approval, if they've applied within Canada for permanent residence, if they've passed first stage approval, then they can access OHIP. Certain people with certain types of work permits can also access OHIP, and certain temporary resident permits as well. So the access is actually fairly strictly defined, and it excludes many, many people who have been in Canada, some for many, many years. So there are many people who fall through the cracks of this narrow definition, and people who are failed refugee claimants but have applied for judicial review of that decision, people who have overstayed visitors' visas. There's just an infinite number of other categories of people who are excluded. But even those who fit into those narrow categories that I spoke about, even amongst those people, there are quite a number who still cannot access OHIP. The one major problem is that the process of transferring from one status to another within the immigrant, the immigration system in Canada is extremely bureaucratic, full of delays, a very inefficient system that punishes people. So there are many people who should be able to access OHIP, have the legal status as defined in the statute, but for reasons of administrative delay and bureaucracy are not accessing health care. The other problem, which I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with, is the issue of the three-month residency requirement in Ontario. So that is, you have to have lived in Ontario for 3 months before you can access the OHIP program. And this is a huge problem for newcomers, people who are newcomer residents in Canada, people who have just arrived on a work permit. They have to wait 3 months before they can access health care, the OHIP program. Now, this is not a requirement that is universal across Canada. There are four provinces that have this three-month delay, and New Brunswick, I believe, just last week announced that they are getting rid of that requirement, which is great. So that shows that this is something that can be won. I know there are a number of people who work really hard in advocating for getting rid of the three-month wait, and I think it's something that is possible in Ontario, especially with the example of New Brunswick. So those are the limitations of the OHIP program. In terms of what I was speaking of at the beginning, the interim federal health benefit, which is a health program that's run by the federal government, this is something that is available for, and I'll just define it really loosely, it's people who don't have formalized, regularized status in Canada, but still are allowed to be here. They're allowed to be here. So that includes people like people who have applied for refugee status and haven't had it determined yet. So they're allowed to be here while that process is ongoing. It also applies to failed refugee claimants who are waiting. There's a whole number of stages to go through before somebody can be removed from Canada. And while that process is ongoing, then they can access the federal interim health benefit. There are a number of countries that are considered so dangerous that even Canada won't deport them back to those countries. So people from those countries are also able to access this benefit. So there's a number of people who fall in this gray area where they don't have kind of formalized status, but they're allowed to be here. And they can access the interim federal health benefit. And this benefit serves approximately 95,000 people in Canada every year. Now, there are a number of problems with this benefit. It is by no means a replacement for OHIP. Some of the problems with it include it's limited to emergency and essential health care coverage only. And that what that means can be very unclear, both to patients and to medical professionals. So it's not uncommon for patients to feel as though they're dealing with a health emergency, to go for help, and then to get a bill months later, once the people who run this program decide that their health issue was not serious enough to warrant getting coverage under the program. The program doesn't cover routine examinations and treatment. It covers the cost of essential medications only. Ongoing mental health services are not covered by the program. It's a huge issue. We have many people coming from situations where they've experienced trauma and other types of issues, and they cannot access the kind of mental health services that they require under this program. There are lots of stories of practitioners who refuse to accept patients who have the interim federal health benefit. It's not always recognized by doctors and emergency room personnel. So I've just covered some of the problems. I'm sure that there are many practitioners who could identify many more, but it's far from a replacement for OHIP. There are many people, like I said, who are allowed to be here, but who live with this kind of second-rate health service for years and years. And I think that's something that really has to change. Okay. I'm told I have 5 minutes left. So now, the impact on communities is something that is readily apparent. There was a study published by some physicians from the Volunteer Uninsured Immigrant and Refugee Clinic in Scarborough, who said 46% of the patients that they saw were applicants who were living in Canada awaiting a decision on their immigration status. And 36% were accepted immigrants who were in that 3-month waiting period. The average length of time that patients had been in the country waiting for health insurance was 2 years, and at the high end it was decades. Now, beyond the cost of medical care, and I do want to just flag this, so the cost of getting medical care for people who are uninsured is an enormous barrier, but the other barrier is fear. Many immigrants and refugees who do not have regularized status, have precarious status, have expressed fear of getting medical assistance because they're afraid that they will be reported to immigration authorities, and there are stories of that happening. So. There really needs to be some clarity about the protections that people have if they're going to come forward and seek medical attention. Now, as I said at the beginning, I call this legalized discrimination in the provision of healthcare, and it is just completely at odds with the equality rights provisions of the Charter and international human rights law. And Canada's flawed immigration system has to take the blame for a lot of what you folks are seeing on the ground. Most people without status have tried to follow correct immigration procedures or are mired in lengthy delays and bureaucratic nightmares that are the defining feature of Canada's immigration system. And I'm just going to identify some of the ways in which our system creates the situation where we have thousands and thousands of people who are here without status or precarious status. One major problem is these inflexible temporary work programs. Canada has become increasingly reliant on temporary workers coming from abroad, and in fact, those numbers are going to increase. Major policy announcements from the federal government are that they're going to increase reliance on temporary workers as opposed to permanent residents as a way for people to enter Canada. Some major problems with that. As I said, it's very inflexible. If people come here and they're working for a very abusive employer, it's very, very difficult to change the employer on your work permit. So if people are in kind of intolerable work situations, if they leave, then they are without status. And this is one way in which many people find themselves living without status in Canada. Canada is very reliant on these temporary workers and on undocumented workers. It's hard to kind of get a handle on the statistics because, of course, people aren't coming forward to be counted, but there is one estimate that in the construction industry alone in Ontario, there were 76,000 non-status immigrants. The construction industry would completely collapse if it was not for the work of people without status. Some of the other problems I'll just highlight quickly in the immigration system, the process for obtaining permanent residence is extremely difficult. It takes years. There are numerous administrative barriers, lax consistency. Decisions often depend on the mood of the immigration officer who has the file coming across their desk that day. It's completely unpredictable. And there are particular barriers for women who are seeking to migrate or to regularize their status. There are many ways in which our immigration system favors male applicants over female applicants, particularly in the point system. And there are many women who are dependent on men, spouses, in order to regularize their status or in order to get status in Canada, which creates all sorts of vulnerabilities in terms of situations of abuse and so on. And of course, the refugee system is extremely flawed. I won't go into some of the reasons for that, but I do like to point out refugee board members get paid more for a negative decision than they do for a positive decision. So, should we be surprised about some of the negative decisions that we see coming out of the board? So I'll just wrap up by saying there are healthcare providers around the world who are really at the forefront on this issue. It's an international movement in many ways with medical professionals who are doing really inspiring, wonderful things to address what is a basic human right, access to healthcare. I'm really excited to be on a panel with these two who are doing really exciting work in Ontario, and I'll let them talk about some of that and some of the gains and some of the there have been some significant gains, but there have also been some great difficulties in Toronto itself. So what I'll end by saying, I agree with Sarah in terms of we have to look at health broadly. If we really want to campaign for health for all, it's not just about access to health care, but it's also about fixing what is an incredibly flawed immigration system in Canada.
Thank you so much, Jackie. Next we have Mana Rihanda, who is a registered midwife in the GTA for the past decade. She has focused much of her clinical practice on working with marginalized women, including new immigrants and the uninsured. Recently, Manavi has opened a new practice with a group of midwives serving the high needs of communities of West Toronto, such as Rexdale and the James Finch Corridor. Manavi is currently the chair of the Association of Ontario Midwives Diversity Committee, and she is the head midwife at Etobicoke General Hospital, William Osler Health Center, and an associate professor at Ryerson University in the Midwifery Education Program. Manavi's graduate work was in the field of bioethics. Thank you for coming.
First, I just wanted to thank the organizers for inviting me to be part of this event. Can you guys hear me okay? You can probably need to also start with a bit of a story. So I'm going to tell the story of Isabella and position her within midwifery care and also point out some of the problems that come up. So Isabella was a migrant worker in Canada. Her husband had come on a work visa, and she came on a visitor's visa. His visa expired, and they both lost their status. They stayed here illegally, quote unquote. She had lived here for 18 years and worked as a cleaner. So in terms of the big argument about contribution to the economy, they had contributed for a long time, getting underpaid. She was pregnant and came to see me because she couldn't go to a doctor. She didn't have health care coverage. She was found on her first ultrasound to have a pretty significant fetal anomaly, had to be seen at a high-risk clinic. They had to pay about $1,000 out of pocket to get all the testing done that they needed. And eventually it was recommended, or offered to her, I shouldn't say recommended, it was offered that because the baby would have so many problems that she would terminate the pregnancy. They considered this, for her to have a termination and the care involved that she would need at the hospital would have cost her $6,000. Alternatively, the hospital I worked at was a Catholic hospital, publicly funded. Termination wasn't an option there. So I couldn't care for her at the hospital I was working in. Eventually, she decided to continue with the pregnancy. There's a whole other side to the story, but the test results were wrong, and the baby was actually fine. That's a different story. 1 week after she had her baby, she came into the office and was very upset and told me that they had gotten a letter from immigration saying that they were being deported. I wrote a letter in response really recommending that at least her deportation be delayed because they were being deported back to Argentina. It's an 18-hour flight. I really didn't think that 1 week postpartum it was actually safe for her to be on a plane for that long. She had a complicated labor. She was deported anyway with her husband. And when someone is deported, Immigration Canada pays for their flight but doesn't. And eventually they are supposed to pay Immigration Canada back. And the idea is we know where these people are now, let's just get them out while we can. The irony was when she came to see me, she was really upset because they didn't have any money and Immigration Canada wouldn't pay for their 1 week old daughter to get back on the plane because they can't deport a Canadian child and they weren't gonna pay for free. And they were very distraught and didn't know where they would come up with the money. and were basically told, well, if you want to abandon a child and leave her in state custody, that's fine. She'll be given up for adoption. They did kind of beg and borrow from everyone they knew and get a ticket for their daughter. Now, the biggest irony of Isabella's story to me is a few years later, I was sitting in my office and I was told by my administrator that I had a repeat client, which happens quite often. And I recognized her name, but I wasn't 100% sure who she was. And she came in and I said, "What?" I said, "Last time I saw you, you were getting on a plane in an hour." She said, "Yeah, we got deported." And I said, "So what are you doing here?" She said, "Oh, my husband got a work visa, so we came back." And I thought, like, it's just a tragic story in a lot of ways, but I was like, what a waste of the system. And the other irony of her story is that her second pregnancy was in the middle of the H1N1 epidemic. Every day we were getting, notices from public health about how women who were pregnant had to be given antiviral medication right away, they should be vaccinated. She showed up in my office. Her daughter clearly to me had H1N1, so I got her out of my office and told her when to call me, and she, sure enough, within 2 days had H1N1. I called the local hospital, told them the story. They said, absolutely, we'll see her. She was now with a work permit, but within her 3-month initial period of being in Canada. And public health was quite adamant that they would treat anybody for free because they were so worried about the pandemic. And she went to the hospital and did not talk to her unless she gave them $600 in cash, which she didn't have. So this brings us to, I just wanted to kind of point out some of the things that come up in the system and explain how midwives fit in. So I'm going to do a really quick overview of midwifery care, talk about some of the solutions and barriers, and maybe end with some of the kind of systemic solutions we can have. So midwives are primary caregivers in Ontario. We are legislated and recognized and have been since 1992. We're fully funded by the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. And one of the questions I was asked was how we negotiated getting funding for uninsured women. So originally when midwifery was funded, we were actually funded through what was then the Community Health Services branch, which doesn't exist anymore. It was the same branch that CHCs were funded from. There were a couple of reasons for this. One is that the ministry was really adamant that they would not fund another fee-for-service model. It wasn't working, it was costing the system too much money. They were very clear that no new healthcare practitioner would come in being able to work fee-for-service. We also, as midwives, were very adamant that we wanted a funding structure that followed our model of care versus changing our model of care to follow a fee structure. And we very much believe that we provided whole care, like an entire course of care to a woman, pregnancy, labor, postpartum, and to her child for 6 weeks postpartum. And we didn't want our care to be fragmented or seen as a series of procedures or a series of visits. We wanted it to be seen as full care. So the ministry didn't want fee-for-service. We didn't actually want fee-for-service either. We're not actually salaried. We're independent contractors, which is complicated and about labor law more than anything else. But we're very highly capped. And so what that means is that there's very little incentive to change our model of care. So there's no incentive, because we can only see a certain number of clients a year, there isn't really incentive to make our visits 5 minutes or take another 100 clients into care, because we can't do that. And we wanted a system that made us stay true to our model of care over time. The other thing that's important to know about midwifery is that we are a managed healthcare program. So one of the things they really didn't want to have happen, which has happened with other primary caregivers, is so a doctor, for example, can decide there's 50 clinics in North York, but I want to open clinic number 51, and it's an independent business. And what that's led to is serious regionalization and urbanization of healthcare resources, and they didn't want that with midwifery. So we work in group practices. We're fully funded by the province. but you have to apply to the province and show geographical and patient need in your area and then get approved for funding. And because of that, the ministry is able, that's why it's called a managed program, they're able to manage where midwifery practices are set up. So midwives are primary caregivers, meaning that if someone's having a well, low-risk pregnancy, they don't need to see anybody else in their pregnancy. They would only see their midwife. And in fact, seeing a midwife and a doctor is double billing the system, so you can't do it. We have a pretty defined scope of practice in terms of what low-risk healthy women and babies mean. So we would consult when appropriate and transfer care when appropriate. And that's one of the barriers when it comes to caring for the uninsured that I will get into. 75% of hospitals in Ontario that offer maternity care now have midwives integrated into the system. And we have a limited pharmacopoeia, similar to nurse practitioners, so we can prescribe drugs on our own accord that are very specific to midwifery care. It's a 4-year university program or a 1-year program for midwives to be trained abroad. They can come here and get retrained and licensed. Midwifery really is being touted as a success story in women-centered and family-centered care. It's very individualized and responsive. We do a lot of health promotion and education. Our average appointments are about 30 to 45 minutes long. There are 3 main tenets of midwifery care, and I'm not going to spend too much time talking about midwifery because I want to talk about some of the issues more with the uninsured, but I know that some people aren't going to be familiar with midwifery. We offer what we call continuity of care, so you have midwives who are on call for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We offer informed choice, so we really see the woman as a primary decision maker, the woman and her family or whoever she defines as her main people, and we offer choice of birthplace. And I think a lot of people associate midwifery with home birth. It's very important for the only caregivers who deliver babies at home safely. But the majority of midwifery clients choose to deliver in the hospital. So about 70%, eventually 70 to 75% of babies delivered by midwives are born in the hospital. In 2003, the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care did a very comprehensive review of midwifery and had some key findings. Interestingly, they didn't publish some of these key findings because they didn't want doctors to be upset by some of them. And doctors have a lot of political but one of the key findings that they did find that they didn't publish was that midwifery, we had very good rates of clinical outcome. So very comparable rates of mortality and morbidity with babies and moms with much lower rates of intervention. And very high rates of client satisfaction. So our client satisfaction rate was over 98%. And anyone who knows anything about obstetrics and maternity care knows that that's kind of one of the biggest issues in terms of legal battles is people's unhappiness with the system, not just that outcome. And midwifery overall really results in significant savings to the healthcare system. And that's because I'm the midwife, I'm the nurse, I'm the family doctor in the hospital setting or at home unless something goes wrong. So we kind of perform all of those roles. We consult when appropriate. The average estimate was that a midwifery-assisted hospital birth saves the system about $800. And a midwifery-assisted home birth saves the system about $1,800. And that's really due to the lower rates of intervention, people leaving the hospital sooner or avoiding being in the hospital altogether, and a much lower rate of readmission to hospital. So we're really now starting to be seen as an important solution in terms of the healthcare crisis, especially there's, for people who know maternity care, there is an impending maternity care crisis. Obstetricians are retiring at very high rates. People aren't going into obstetrics at the same rate. Family doctors who used to do a significant portion of obstetrical care don't anymore for a variety of reasons. So just to kind of let you know the uninsured picture. So like community health center doctors, we are funded to take care of uninsured women. And, you know, some people would argue there's benefits to that. I definitely think there's huge benefits to that. Some people would say the downside is you can't control how much money you make. But so for a new immigrant woman or an uninsured woman or a non-status woman who comes here, women who are in a three-month waiting period who have landed immigrant status often don't know that they're not covered when they get here. So you wait 3 years to get your immigration, you're pregnant when it comes, and it's a lottery ticket. Like, you're really lucky to get your immigration in lots of places in the world. And so you either go to Canada, which is the land of opportunity, and have your baby there, and why wouldn't you, because everything's free here and you're covered, or you stay back, lose your immigration, and reapply with another child. And, you know, by the time the child comes up again, you might be pregnant again, depending on what your family planning is and what your age is and all of those kinds of things. So many women in that three-month waiting period will show up. Many, the majority will come to Ontario because that's where many immigrants end up. And when they get here, then they find out that they don't have coverage. So a woman in that situation, for example, at 32 or 33 weeks of pregnancy, she can go to a walk-in clinic, but they don't do any continuity or prenatal care, but she can go for the occasional visit or test. She can go to an obstetrician. Almost all obstetricians require a retainer fee to talk to anybody who has no health coverage. The average retainer fee, when I say average, it's really like for me talking to doctors I've known at 3 or 4 different hospitals, so I'm talking about Toronto, but it's about $3,000. So you want to see me for one visit, you give me $3,000 and then we'll talk. They can go to a community health center. Now, the big problem with community health centers is they're often closed to new patients because they get filled up so quickly. Most of the family doctors at community health centers now don't do obstetrical care, so they'll refer you to an obstetrician. That's okay, because if you become a patient of the CHC, they'll cover the obstetric fee, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. The other problem is many CHCs, if you're more than 32 weeks pregnant, won't take you, period. And because by that point you're being referred to an OB anyway. So often when people show up at our door, and it's one of the great ironies of midwifery, is that midwifery in Canada is really seen as Cadillac care. Historically, we started out being kind of care for the elite because it was private, and so it was a very kind of upper middle class educated group of women that really longed to get midwifery legislated. And we have an interesting thing happening now where the majority of clients that we have, if you look at our demographics, are still women who live in higher income postal codes than kind of the average Canadian woman. But so we have kind of this very high income, I want individualized care group of women that comes to midwives. And then this very low income, we have no health insurance. If we had money, we would go to an obstetrician because we're not really sure what a midwife is. And we don't necessarily want to be here, but everybody else is closing the door, so I'm here. So it's an interesting kind of zone that we're in. And I've had OBs say to me, like, I don't understand why all these women are showing up because I know a lot of your clients are wealthy. And I'll say, yeah, but our wealthy immigrant clients come to you. They don't come to me because there is a certain cachet about being in Canada and being able to have a doctor. We are funded to take care of uninsured women, and that's great, but there are a lot of barriers in the system. So one of the biggest ones is that I'm funded. I go to my family doctor and I say, can I consult with you because this woman has a respiratory infection? And that woman either has to pay the consultation fee. Now, for respiratory infection, it's not a big deal. For cesarean section, it's going to cost her a few thousand dollars. That obstetrician, she doesn't have a few thousand dollars. That obstetrician turns around to me and says, you can imagine the interprofessional issues that come up. Even good guy obstetrician or good woman obstetrician, 10 cases later that month, is going to be like, so you're getting paid for this, and I'm not. And it becomes a very interprofessional, individualized thing instead of being seen as a systemic problem. Now, my argument is I'm not standing at the airport with a sign saying, come this way, these people are here, someone needs to deal with them. It's good that I can see women and screen them for risk and decrease their risk. But it's true, when something very complicated comes up, I don't work in a silo and I have to work with consultants, and even the most, you know, well-natured consultants can feel like it's a burden after a certain amount of time. The other thing that's a big issue is midwifery, you know, we're over 15 years being legislated in this province, but when I was a student, we had 50 registered midwives in Ontario. We now have 400 registered midwives. That's a massive cure. We're doing 10% of the births in this province. When I was a student, we were doing less than 1%. 10% was some crazy dream that, like, maybe one day we'll get there, and we're there, and that's great. But we're still not the norm, and we're still not so common. So you have a fairly new profession going into hospital environments, trying to integrate themselves, and different hospitals have very different environments. So some midwives can work in places that are hostile, and some midwives can work in environments that are very friendly. And if you add the non-OHIP interprofessional issues on top of that, it can really affect client care. And that's not even, and one of the good things about talking to people in this room is most people really understand the underlying issues of racism and discrimination that are at play when you're dealing with uninsured populations. But, you know, add all of those things together and you can end up really having compromised care, and you can end up with strained interprofessional relationships. And the way that midwives have chosen to handle that, some midwifery practices will say, we'll see you, but we want to take the $3,000 retainer fee that the OB would take, because if I have to consult, I'm not ruining my relationship with that OB, because I'm going to only care for every other woman that I care for. That's a pretty extreme response, but it's out there. Other clinics like ours will say, no one else is going to see these women. I'll, you know, fight the good fight and reserve spots for non-insured women. It's estimated right now there are about 200,000 to 300,000 uninsured people in Ontario. Anywhere from 16% to 30% of those women are childbearing age. Every midwife in Toronto could take care of only uninsured clients, and we're denting that. So it also really, I mean, it's not the only solution by any stretch. The other thing is, you know, in terms of home birth, it can save the system a lot of money. It can save the woman a lot of money because she has to pay facility fees. Now, facility fees is a whole other issue. Some hospitals will have you pay $500, some have you pay $1,800 a day. If you have a C-section that you didn't want because you had a breech baby, but there was no doctor who delivered the baby vaginally, then you have to stay for 3 days and they're going to charge you $5,000 because you didn't have, like, it's just, you know, there's so many layers. And part of that is that there's no systemic way that hospitals have decided in Ontario, and I just went to an Ontario Hospital Association conference earlier today where we were really talking about how some hospitals look at the uninsured as a cash cow, like as a way for us to actually make more money. And so, you know, instead of getting $600 that we would for this patient, we're going to charge them $1,800. You know, one out of every four of our patients don't pay, so we're going to charge four times as much so that one person who does pay, like, it just, it really goes on, and there's a lot of systemic stuff behind that. In terms of prenatal, or I'm going to talk about community health centers for 1 second. So in terms of solutions, one of the biggest solutions that midwives have found is to make alliances with community health centers. So community health centers, because they don't necessarily have doctors who take care of pregnant women and will refer to an OB, you can instead, they can refer to a midwife. They don't have to pay the midwifery fee, but they can still pay the lab fees. And so that's been one of the solutions. Again, community health centers have limited resources, so that's a big problem. So that's just kind of framing the issue. The only thing I just want to end on is, we talked today at this Ontario Health Association conference about choosing winnable strategies. And I think, you know, in the battle in healthcare for all, there's two really winnable strategies right now. One is eliminating the 3-month waiting period. And the other, because I think moms and babies are pretty compelling, regardless of how conservative you are, is that to have free prenatal care for anybody who's pregnant in Ontario. Prenatal care has been proven in so many ways to be incredibly cost-effective. It's estimated that for every dollar spent on prenatal care, we save $2.50. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that adds up to billions of dollars. And there's a really well-researched, well-documented difference in outcome for babies. And so obviously, I'm a bit biased because that's what I do, but I honestly think that's one of the potential places to start the strategy in a very minimal
Next, we have Mehmed Rashid, who is a family physician with a particular interest in immigrant and refugee health. He has worked in the community health center sector for the last 13 years and is currently working at the Department of Family Medicine at St. Joseph's Hospital. He was on the steering... I'm reading this for the first time or anything, but he was on the steering committee for the recent Canadian Refugee Health Conference and is on the steering committee of the Canadian Collaboration on Immigrant and Refugee Health, a body developing evidence-based guidelines for the assessment of newly arrived immigrant and refugees. He has also had the opportunity to work in healthcare settings in Nicaragua, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania. Thanks so much.
I really want to thank Olivia and Dr. All for putting this on and for inviting me. I've been really amazed at your events over the last few months. And again, thank you for highlighting this critical issue. Because I was listening to these two fantastic speakers, I realized, I think there's a difference of about 7 or 8 years between us. And she's got a computer and I've got a scrap computer. And I just realized it's a generational issue here. So anyway, my eyesight's not as good anymore, so I'm trying to read these notes. As much as I can. I'll start with the story that just sort of came to mind. I had a patient a few years ago. We've been in the country about 12 years, originally from South America. And, I always worried about a mental health diagnosis in him because he was so paranoid. He didn't have any status here. He had a job. He was working as a mechanic. He'd actually moved close to where he worked so he wouldn't have to leave the house. So he'd go to work, sort of hang low there, he'd go home. He was afraid to go out. He was sometimes afraid to come into the clinic for his medical issues. And he had some pretty significant medical issues. Ironically, his boss, when they asked him to go out, and they went out, and his boss just ended up drinking. And this patient of mine didn't drink. And his boss was quite inebriated, so he was helping him get into a car somewhere on Bloor and Royal York, I think. When the police came by, and they stopped, and they noticed this guy was sort of being dragged into a car, and they stopped. And of course, they looked over at my patient and asked him for ID. And it was ironic, and again, when I graduated from medical school, we knew very little about the uninsured, and I really thank initiatives like this that helped educate all of us. But for me, it was really sort of an interesting experience because, in some ways, his inability to go out and socialize, at least a lot of people uninsured who were working, who would socialize, seemed a bit absurd to me. I really was wondering whether he was obsessive or had agoraphobia. But in the end, I think his story played out in a way that was quite instructive for me. I should tell you that I've worked at the CHCs for about 12, 13 years. I'm now working at St. Joe's Hospital. I worked at probably the 12 CHCs in Toronto. So I think I've sort of been educated over my years through my different experiences. The CHC is a little bit different, but I would suggest almost all of them, at least in Toronto, see people who are uninsured. And for me, it's been a really tremendous education. I'd like to share with you maybe a couple of biases I have. These are probably no surprises, but I really believe health is a human right, and I think everyone deserves access to health care regardless of their immigration status. And it might be a bit of a cop-out that I'm not a politician or an economist, but I realize issues on how you sort of work towards that are not easy, but I think that's really important to start in my mind. The other bias that maybe I'll just sort of put out there is that, in a sense, I find it very distasteful that many of us have really been rewarded by the work that people who are uninsured have done in Toronto. And in the boom in the 90s, the construction industry, to a large part, was fueled by the work of uninsured people. Many people have nannies who are uninsured here. And so in times of economic benefit, we've certainly reaped the benefits. But yet, when it becomes politically appropriate, I think we've seen large moves to deport uninsured workers, and I feel that's quite distasteful. I've been asked that you come and speak a little bit about the CHC model of care, and I see a lot of colleagues from CHCs, and so I think the majority of you out there probably have worked either at CHCs or had contact with community health centers. So bear along with me if this seems a little bit basic. For those of you that haven't, community health centers, of which there's over 60 now in Ontario, are quite unique in their provision of healthcare. So there was a time about 3 or 4 years ago where I think there was about 200 physicians who worked in CHCs, and you compare that to about 20,000 physicians in Ontario. So it's a fairly small number. It's grown a little bit, I think, since that initial staff came about, but it's really a drop in the bucket. They're unique in a couple of ways. So one, they really emphasize multidisciplinary teams. So it's not just physicians that are there. There are nurse practitioners, there's nurses, there's social workers, there's dietitians. Some community health centers have chiropodists, some have physiotherapists. Many have health promoters. I've worked with fantastic researchers. So it's a fairly broad array of services, which makes them quite unique in primary care. The other thing from a physician point of view is we're salary. And I think that opens up to a lot of opportunities, particularly in working with people who are uninsured. So I'm just going to run you through sort of the trajectory of what happens with uninsured people once they get into a CHC. And I'll sort of leave the part about getting into the CHC for a little bit later, because that I think is a critical point. When we see, when a patient is seen at a CHC who is uninsured, really the care that we can provide is exactly the same as it is for people who have health care. So meaning they have access to all the services. Because we're salaried, there really is no, there's no difference for us. For a physician, really the health status becomes insignificant. And they can be approached in really the exact same way as someone who has IFH or someone who has all that. Where it differs is when you're accessing healthcare services outside the center. So, for example, if you need a blood test run, if you need an x-ray, if you need an ultrasound, if you have to send somebody to a consultant. Now, community health centers are, as far as I know, the only funding model is actually funding so that we can pay for some of those services. So, for example, if you come and see me and you're uninsured and you need a blood test, we actually have a pot of funds that comes from your remains, local health care number, that will allow us to cover the costs of those tests. So we can cover x-rays, we cover ultrasounds, we can cover CAT scans, we can cover MRIs. And if we need to send you to a cardiologist, we can actually pay the fees for the cardiologist. So in many ways, if you're working with people uninsured, it really is a very novel primary care model. And I would argue that it's probably the only model where I think you can feel comfortable working with people uninsured. The other, I think, a tremendous asset of community health centers is that there's an amazing capacity to do advocacy. So we have had health promoters work on many campaigns. We were quite involved around a series of deportations that happened around 2006. At that time, I think I'd been working at the health center I'd been at for about 3 or 4 years, and I had maybe 3 or 4 people have been deported. Over the first 3 months of the Harper government, we had over 40 people who were deported. And we still sort of debate this with some of our colleagues in the legal world, and I've been told many times that there's just sort of a wave where people are working through different communities. But from the ground, it felt quite different. And certainly the current on the street was quite different. We were hearing stories from people saying that there were raids going on in Dufferin Mall, the construction bans were being stopped. And what we were starting to find was that people weren't coming for appointments. So we'd have people coming for prenatal care, which we do a little bit, but not certainly not as much as we do now when we start referring to midwives. And people stopped coming. People stopped coming for their diabetes follow-up. And we were really able to bring together a number of healthcare workers in Toronto across the country and try to advocate for them. So we put on a press conference. And again, that's quite unique. It's very hard to do that in other models, and at least have the support of a multidisciplinary team. So they really are tremendous places to work at when you're talking about issues that affect the insured. The other thing you should mention is that if you come to Canada, you're uninsured, you get hit by a car and go to hospital. Mommy was speaking to facility fees. I don't know if everyone knows what those are. But really, if you go into a hospital to an emergency department, the physician fees might be, off the top of my head, $40, $50. But to walk in through the door, in most hospitals, you're spending anywhere from $200 to $400. And that fee goes directly to the hospital. So community health centers can pay the fee for the physicians, but for some reason, this is a decision that goes back decades, they cannot pay for the facility. So that includes emergency room visits, that includes hospitalizations, that includes elective surgery. And that's really the bulk of the fees. If you go in for elective surgery, you might not stay the night, but it still can add up to about $1,000. So one of the things that health centers have been able to do is to advocate with hospitals so that the facility fee they pay, that they demand from their clients or from their patients, is the equivalent that you pay under OPA. Without that advocacy, they can actually charge up to 3 times more. And I think Mondi was sort of speaking to this, that, you know, it's a bit of a crapshoot. The last time I looked into it a couple years ago, if you went to Humber, it cost about $450 to go in through the emergency room. If you went to St. Joe's, it was $220. And they could actually ask for 3 times more. So in some ways, being a client of a CHC allows you to advocate for at least the older fee to be requested instead of their own fee. And where that doesn't happen, you know, there are people at health centers who've done some tremendous advocacy. So it's a phenomenal amount of work. You know, you call, you hassle, you threaten, you call the Trump star, blah, 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 blah. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I work with people who are very skilled in doing that, and frightening me, so I never cross that. Okay, what are the problems? And we sort of speak to some of these issues when we talk about prenatal care. So one, facility fee is a huge issue. So, you know, there are people who require elective, semi-elective surgery and choose not to get it done. There are people who perhaps need a cesarean section or prefer not to have a home birth, but will do so only to save the cost. And, you know, again, that is not ideal healthcare. Certainly anything that's not covered by OHIP, CHCs cannot pay for. So again, this is now a broad basket of services, physiotherapy, optometrists, medications, dental, and those become tremendous burdens when we talk about health. I think for me, and maybe the one issue that I'd like to focus on a bit is capacity. And those of you who've worked with people out there, we've tried to get in the community health center, realize that there's a tremendous issue around capacity. So, you know, what I hear from my folks in public health, great service, cardiac care, can't get anyone in, right? And, you know, from where I sit, that's certainly been true. My personal opinion is that, you know, there certainly are efficiencies, I think, in all worlds in primary health care that we've looked at and probably are quite slow to be embraced, but there are certainly efficiencies that could be optimized in those community health centers that I've worked with. I think the bigger issue really speaks to the model of care. So again, if you come and see me at the community health center, I will check behind your ears and between your toes, and it really will provide you, you know, your tetanus shot, and everything, right? You'll get fantastic care, right? Half an hour appointments, you'll meet our social worker, you'll talk to our dietitian, you'll make you skinny, you'll make you big, whatever you want to do. The problem is that we're taking care of a few hundred people. And in the end, if the numbers we're hearing, you know, we're talking about 125 people in Toronto alone, it really is a drop in the bucket. To me, one of sort of my heroes in working with the uninsured is Paul Caulfield, who many of you know. And you know, he's been a tireless advocate in setting up a clinic that provides very different care. It's really walk-in care. I was at a conference presenting a couple years ago at a tuberculosis conference here in Toronto, and someone presented a case of a woman who had come here from Mexico, 30 years old, previously healthy, who developed a cough. And she just didn't have the money to access healthcare. She had this cough for 18 months. By the time she actually presented, I've never seen an x-ray like this. It was just a complete whiteout. You know, she died of tuberculosis. A 30-year-old woman in Toronto, right, died of tuberculosis. And a completely treatable illness that caught early. Because I sort of digested that story, which to me is unimaginable. I started realizing what Dr. Caulfield and his colleagues have done in the Scarborough is really something that's quite a unique model. And in some ways, I think CHCs are sort of uniquely poised to perhaps learn from that model. And we started talking amongst a few of us at the health center where I was at. And, you know, the idea of providing very high-intensity care to a low volume of people, in my mind, might not be the ideal way of approaching it. So in a sense, it's great to look behind your ears, but there are people out there walking around on broken legs or mothers who have babies who have fevers in the middle of the night. They don't know where to go. And you know, we started talking about having a model where CHCs would perhaps be able to pool their resources, the funds they have for the uninsured, and run a walk-in clinic that could be staffed by salaried physicians. And I know there's been some interest in the CHC sector. I probably can't speak to how quickly it's been pushed forward. But in many ways, I think that the issue that we keep hearing is that there are models of care that work, but we just don't have the capacity to deal with them. To implement a model like that's a bit complicated, right? In some ways, I think you'd need to have hospitals that would be on site. And I think that's quite doable. I think the issue of cost effectiveness is something that arguably needs to be researched further, but I think it's actually quite a reasonable argument to make. All hospitals are running deficits, I should say all, but the majority in Toronto are running deficits, right? They're cutting services. They're not interested in getting into new projects. Nevertheless, many of them are being burdened by costs of dealing with people uninsured, and that's the way they'll phrase it. Right? And so to be able to sell the idea of a walk-in clinic that would be able to bring people away from their emergency departments and have a place that's run by CHC physicians where there's a pot of funds to actually cover some of those costs, I think might be actually quite well received in some of the downtown teaching hospitals. So anyway, there's some interesting models. I completely agree it's tweaking. I think there are larger issues that people have spoken to, which speak to issues around housing and providing access to food and changing immigration laws that make it more reasonable than people do arrive here. But nevertheless, I think there is the opportunity to provide more health care to more people. I look forward to the conversations. Perhaps getting input from any of you here with such tremendous experience working with insured. The last thing I'll sort of leave you with is I think there's a real crisis in research around working with uninsured. We all quote Paul Colford's study, those of us in healthcare, in 2007, it's a medical association journal. But when you scan the literature, at least in Canada, that's probably it. And I think there's been some really interesting work that's been out there that just hasn't gotten into the medical journals. But I think as clinicians, we really need to spend some time documenting what we're doing and be able to use that as a source of evidence. Again, I thank you for inviting me here to speak.